Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Zucker, the doc in docology. Autism has been increasing rapidly in this country over the past few decades. In fact, the CDC reported just yesterday that 1 in 31 children by the age of 8 were found to be on the autism spectrum disorder. That's 3% of American kids, 3%. And despite billions of dollars of research over the years, its causes are still unclear. So it was quite surprising last week, and frankly, a little troubling, when Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, proclaimed that he's going to find the cause of autism by the end of the summer. Now, proving in 5 months what remains a mystery 5 decades into the search for answers. So, ambitious goal, and we could talk about that in a little bit. But I just finished listening to his press conference this past hour on autism, and he raises concerns about environmental factors, and we're going to talk about that as well. But the secretary has been a proponent of the theory that vaccines cause autism, and this is the concept that has been debunked time and time again by scientists. So some people are concerned that he plans to sort of cook the books and use suspect methods to validate his preconceived wrong idea. And so that's our topic of investigation today, all about autism and what do we know about autism? What remains for us to understand? And we're turning to someone who knows this subject inside and out. Dr. Helen Tager-Flusberg has spent over 45 years researching autism. She leads the Center for Autism Research Excellence at Boston University and is the former president of the International Society for Autism Research. Her work has shaped the way we understand autism, not just as a diagnosis, but as a diverse, complex part of the human experience. Dr. Tager-Flusberg, welcome. It is a pleasure to have you here. You've had an extraordinary career spanning 5 decades. But before we get to the latest news out of CDC yesterday, and also the news just made in the last hour by Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy, maybe you could take us back to the beginning and what first drew you to study autism as a young graduate student, because back then the field didn't have the level of attention that it has today. So I thought maybe you could share a little bit about that with us.
Well, when I was a doctoral student, my passion was to study language and language development in particular. And I was encouraged by my advisor to study language development across lots of different groups of children. That way, I thought we will learn so much more about what's at the heart of language and what are some of the underlying factors that make language such an extraordinary achievement for most children who acquire language without any effort in such a brief period of time. And yet there are these other children for whom acquiring language is such a struggle or even something that they really can never achieve. And so that's what drew me to studying autism. I think I was also very influenced to focus on disabilities. I grew up with 2 siblings who had developmental disabilities. They were not diagnosed with autism, though whether they would receive such a diagnosis today is very much an open question. So mm-hmm. That's what drew me to it. I was really interested in language. And at the time that I entered the field, in fact, one of the main hypotheses was that language problems were at the root of the more obvious social communicative problems that define this behavioral disorder. And so that's how I got into the field. And then over the years, the pathway to where we are today in the field is really what has been so compelling and so exciting because we have made so much progress. I will tell you that studying autism back in the 70s when I was a doctoral student was no mean achievement. The rates in the population were pegged at around 1 in 25,000, compared to the report from yesterday, as you pointed out, 1 in 31. So you can imagine that finding participants for my study, that in and of itself was quite a challenge for me.
Well, out of curiosity, are your siblings, do they have challenges with language as well as part of their developmental issues?
My younger sister did. She did speak, but she didn't have what we'd call fluent language. But she was able to communicate very well using spoken language.
I mean, I will tell you that as a kid, I didn't speak until I was close to four. And now in retrospect, you know, that's a little concerning, particularly with a father who's a pediatrician, so who actually delivered me. So you could really brings that back to home a little bit. So I'm sure, you know, that's one of these challenges. I'm curious about you must have some stories or experiences that captured your curiosity as you've followed through all your all these years in your career that maybe you could share with us about patients with autism or just in general.
Well, I think I was very struck, even at the beginning of my career, how varied, how different each of the children, because I was focusing on children at the time, how different each of them were. And I would always go back and reread, which is something I still do every few years, go back and read the original paper in which Leo Kanner, who was a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University, first described the 11 children to which he gave the name of this new disorder. He called it infantile autism, but what we today would call autism spectrum disorder. And it's so varied, and particularly in terms of the children's language. So several of the children that he saw did have quite fluent language, whereas others had no spoken language at all. Yeah, and he focused on the unusual characteristics of their language, that they tended to repeat back what you heard, that they also would sometimes reverse pronouns. So they'd refer to themselves as you and to the other person as I. And this was an unusual feature. And he highlighted those sort of clinical characteristics that distinguished autistic language from other children acquiring language in different ways. And I was struck by a lot of the variability and that what was clear was language, they didn't really see language as a way to connect and really communicate. They would respond to what you asked them if they had the spoken language abilities to do so. They would respond if they wanted something. They'd make a request, they'd ask you for it in their own special ways. But they never told you. I mean, if you say, well, how was your day today? You'd never get much of a response from them. I think what's most striking to me is the change over time, that over the course of my career. You know, children back in the 70s, there were very little intervention. Many of these kids were sort essentially institutionalized or in schools where there was nothing much happening for the children. They were sitting around. Nobody was providing them with rich interactions, rich experiences, learning experiences and opportunities. And so on reflection, I think a lot of what I saw and documented in my research back in the early days was partly the fact that you had these children who were not receiving the kinds of interventions and educational opportunities that we are giving children today. And I think, so the kids I see today are very different, unless they are at, still at the very severe end, and we do study that that population as well, what we call profound autism. But even then, the profoundly autistic children today have so much richer lives than we were giving them 40, 50 years ago.
Thank you. That's a great background to the issues that that we're talking about today on the CDC report. So I wanted to go back to that because that report came out yesterday, and it says that there's a rise in the number of cases of autism. And why such a disturbing trend? Maybe you could share with us a little bit about what you think may be contributing to that, and then we can get into a little bit about the science of autism as well.
Okay. So actually, I think what's most striking and revealing about the report that came out yesterday, which is also true about reports that these reports come out every 2 years from the CDC, and we've seen this trend before. But to me, what captures my attention is the enormous variability across states. Okay, so, and across locations within states. So I think this might be the first time that Texas has been included in this monitoring research, this looking forth what the prevalence rates were. And in Texas, they picked two locations. They picked Houston, which is a major city. It has a very prominent autism center that has been there for decades. So it's a very sophisticated urban area. And then the second district that they looked at was Laredo, Texas. And the rates of autism in Houston and Laredo were so vastly different. Okay. And to me, that's where the clues are as to what's going on with how to interpret these rising rates in autism. Another clue in the report yesterday is that whereas a decade ago, diagnoses of autism were far higher in white children compared to minority children, Black, Hispanic kids, that's now flipped. Now we're seeing rates higher in Hispanic and Black children compared to white children. So these demographic changes and differences, to me, point to where the clues are. I don't think that there's something different in the air, that there's something different in the lives of kids in Houston compared to Laredo, Texas, but there are other factors. There isn't an autism center in Laredo. That's in a very rural area. Texas is a gigantic state. And in Laredo, Texas, I am quite certain, although I haven't had time to check into it today, that the capacity to provide diagnoses for children with autism are extremely limited in contrast to what's available in Houston.
So let me see if I hear you correctly. What you're saying is the ability to diagnose someone is contributing to this because in a community where they don't have the facilities, resources, whatever it may be, will end up having more or less cases, I should say less cases, whereas in the facilities or the cities where there are more. And do you think that goes, because I saw the report, California, New Jersey, Pennsylvania had a lot of cases. And I'm going to get to the secretary in a minute because he mentioned California in his press conference in the last hour. Do you think that's also contributing to that?
Yes, there are major autism centers in every location that the rates are significantly higher. Okay. And And diagnostic services are far more available, and intervention services and educational opportunities are far more accessible in the areas where we're seeing significantly higher rates.
So that goes to the diagnosing of the problem, but then we go back to the cause of the problem, which I thought we could talk a little bit about, right? Why are there more cases, even if everyone's able to diagnose this? What is happening on a medical level? And maybe you could share a little bit about that.
Okay, well, so as you pointed out, this has been studied for, well, actually the year that I began my own research in this field, the most important study was published. It came out of the UK, conducted by a woman who later became my colleague, and Susan Falstein, and Professor Michael Rutter, who is someone I knew when I was still living in the UK. They did a twin study. They identified every twin that had been diagnosed, where at least one of the twins had been diagnosed with autism. And Susan Falstein ran around, took her car, drove and the trains all around the UK, following up and meeting with these twins. And what she found was that the rates of autism were significantly, if one twin had autism, you ask, well, does the other twin have autism? Among the identical twins who shares, sorry about that, who share their genetics, the rates were significantly higher than in the so-called fraternal twins, who only share, in quotes, 50% of their genes. And that is a primary clue to a disorder having a genetic basis. Over the years, their work was replicated with much larger samples. And in every single twin study that's been conducted now on literally thousands of pairs of twins, we know that the rates are significantly higher in the identical twins who share genetics. So since then, of course, the work on the genetics of autism has advanced considerably. Identifying some specific risk genes for autism, and also the identifying what are what we call common variants. Let's say things that we all have, different variants, but perhaps cumulatively they lead to a behavioral profile that matches what we call autism today. So we know about that. In terms of non-genetic factors, again, there have been studies investigating this for many years now. And we do know some things about some of the non-genetic factors. So we know a good deal about the role of the prenatal environment. So if mothers contract infections, or if in fact they have some chronic illness that leads to inflammation, we know that that is an additional risk in the baby, okay? But it's a small risk relative to the genetics. And there are some studies that even suggest that even that is interacting with the genetics itself. Severe stress is something that might be associated with autism. Again, these are not easy factors to investigate, but there does seem to be some evidence for that. Some medications lead to an increased risk, but again, it's a complicated story. So mothers who take medications, if they have a seizure disorder, such as valproic acid, that's an additional risk factor. But then again, you know, Seizure disorders are common in autism too, and so there's that shared genetic risk for a seizure disorder. And so you can't just say, well, let's put the genetics in this pile and the environment in that pile. It's all about how they're interacting. What the genetics provides as a predisposition.
So this is, I'm sorry, continue.
So what about exposures? There's always been stories about exposures. And if they've always been, there was a very famous case in New Jersey. It's called the Brick Township in New Jersey. And there were, you know, it was a very polluted area from the factories around there. And it seemed like there was quite an excess of cases in that area compared to the surrounding region in New Jersey. It's extremely hard when you're dealing with small samples to say definitively this was an environmental exposure that contributed to the increase in cases in autism. The statistics around epidemiology are complex. It could be coincidental. And so it's always hard. We know that that's true when you're investigating the role of environmental exposures for cancer and for other factors. It's not so easy to identify that. But I would put my money on polluted areas. Pollution from factories probably affects the environment in lots of different ways that may lead to other kinds of complex diseases. And then the question is, what are we going to do with that information?
So I'm want to go to RFK, the secretary's press conference an hour ago, because I wrote down a couple things he said, and it goes towards what you were just talking about. One of the things he said, I'm quoting, he said that there are genetic markers, but they provide a vulnerability. And he says you need an environmental toxin. And he says that they will look at foods, medicine, molds, ultrasound, because as he said, it was ubiquitous at the period when the numbers went up. But he also said, and I want to be sure I think I wrote this down correctly. He said it's an environmental exposure. Genes won't cause it. And that the amount of money put into studying genes, and I want to be sure I said it right, I think he said was sort of a dead issue. I'm sort of paraphrasing some of what he said on that second part. But that is concerning because they are going to do a study that they plan to look at things by September, or have some answers by September, if not all the answers, although he did say that, you know, he'll have some answers by September. How would you respond to that? And what if he were here? What would you tell him about those kind of comments? And I understand you're mentioning that environment does play a role. And we all understand that genes and environment work together. But how would you respond to him about some of those comments that he made?
Okay, well, I think he's downplaying the significance of genes. Okay, I think we know that genes, both heritable, what we get from our parents, and spontaneous changes in the DNA, we know that that it is far higher contribution to the causes of autism than environmental exposures. And I say that because we would have found the smoking gun if there indeed was one. I'll give you an example based on the list that you just said. You talked about ultrasound. And that's been a sort of very interesting story. There was an animal study that was done initially, which suggested that in a rodent model of autism, that basically exposures to very intense levels of ultrasound. You saw changes in the behavior of the pups that, you know, you could argue was a kind of an animal model of autism. And this caused quite quite a stir in the field, and everyone was interested in pursuing that. And then people started to look at the human data, because we know, for example, that, you know, we're very good at causing cancer in mice, and we're extremely good at curing cancers in mice, but doesn't always translate to humans, which is why we're still investigating these factors. It doesn't always translate. And it turns out the ultrasound story did not explain any differences in humans. It was not a contributing risk factor. And even, you know, the number of ultrasounds that moms get, even in high-risk pregnancy, is nowhere close to the exposures that were given to those mouse pups. So people have taken every smoking gun and explored it in the human data with large data sets and not found them to amount to very much. We do know that exposure to severe pollution is a contributing risk factor. Again, small relative risk relative to the much larger contribution of genetics.
So then how do we explain this 400% increase? I mean, this is one of the things that's been raised, that if you had one in 10,000 kids, you know, 20 years ago, but now we're looking at these numbers at one in 31. How do we explain that, more than just, you know, we have better testing right now, or better diagnostics, I should say, in general, or identifying these kids? How do we explain that much of a change?
So I will say, I think we know some of the reasons for this. Could there be other things? Absolutely. I think we, you know, a good scientist always has an open mind and doesn't think we've got all the answers at this point. And we don't. We do know the contribution of better diagnosis, the availability of services, some of these factors are a very important contribution to the rise in the numbers, a growing awareness, reduction of stigma. These social factors are very important. They're important in all aspects of medicine. Medicine isn't just about the biology. I'm a psychologist by training, so I certainly am not going to put all my eggs in the biology basket. Are there other factors that are contributing? That may well be the case. But I will say, people have looked extensively. We've had the best epidemiologists on the planet have been focusing on this. And they haven't come up with nearly as much as I expected some of these studies got started 20, 30 years ago, which is interesting. I just don't think 5 months is going to lead to some major new discovery that has eluded scientists for the last two decades.
So the big elephant in the room, and not elephant Republican Democrat, just elephant in the room, that's a pun, but vaccines. Why won't this vaccine myth go away despite the overwhelming amount of science out there? It still keeps coming up. Why is it still there?
It's a very good question. I think I probably my colleagues who are evolutionary psychologists would have their finger on the pulse of a good explanation from the beginning, when the very first vaccines, the smallpox vaccines, when people were going to take cowpox and inject it into a human in order to prevent the onset of a disease. I think that is something that just goes against the grain of how we think, how we conceptualize our body. We have a sense of purity, and so injecting dangerous infectious diseases into our body is something that from the beginning people have had difficulty accepting. Okay, I think we overcame it because vaccines were so successful and there were so many diseases that were eradicated. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, so many babies died before their first year of life, especially in babies living in, less than ideal environments. And that's gone now. We expect every baby born to be able to live a healthy life. We do that and they are able to because we are providing them with all these vaccines. But I think there's something that the human mind doesn't always want to accept. And then we meet one person or we hear one story or two stories. Oh, okay. My baby had their shots at the age of 18 months because that's when the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is given. And then within a few weeks, my baby was diagnosed with autism. Well, you've got a coincidence of timing there because we know that the onset of the behavioral symptoms of autism emerge during the second year of life. And so you're seeing, and we know that across the second year of life, the baby's behaviors begin to change. There's a reduction in their social engagement. They may speak less, vocalize less, communicate and begin to engage in sort of more repetitive toy play at about this time that they're also receiving vaccines. And so the human mind, again, loves to put one and one together to make two. And so they take the vaccine and the emergence of these behaviors or the fact that their pediatrician is diagnosing autism, and they come to the erroneous conclusion that autism was the result of having received that vaccine or that so second.
True, unrelated. True that they got a vaccine. True that they have challenges, but completely unrelated. Going back to that CDC study for a minute and the discussion with the vaccines, it said that there was variability by region, by gender, by socioeconomics, by ethnicity. So how can the vaccines be a cause if there is all this variability, right? You would think that why are there more boys getting autism than girls? And if it was related to a vaccine, then it should be equal, right? And the same with some of the other variabilities that they mentioned in the report.
Well, you could come up with some interpretations. Boys may be more vulnerable to the impact of being vaccinated compared to girls. We know that girls actually are more robust. Their nervous systems are more robust compared to boys as infants. So you could tell that story in terms of the racial ethnic differences, then maybe you would say, okay, a decade ago when autism was more prevalent in whites compared to other minority kids, maybe they were more likely to be vaccinated. There's no evidence for that. People have looked at that. And then we would have to say, well, okay, that's flipped now. White kids are not being vaccinated as much as minority children are. And so that's why the rates have flipped, as opposed to what we know about the sociology of medicine and how you know, different groups have different access to routine medical care. So
what
you could come up, if you wanted a just so story, you'd come up with one.
You know, so that's what we're worried about. We want to make sure we're focused on the science and we're not focused on figuring out how to make a story fit the narratives that we want. And that's very important. You know, as a scientist, you want to be sure it's done the correct way, right?
Okay, that's absolutely true. And that's why you'd start off, well, maybe that's your hypothesis. Okay, that's where you start as a scientist. Okay, my hypothesis is, you know, that if vaccines are a contributing factor, I would search for whether I could explain some of these demographic differences based on the actual uptake of vaccines in infants in those different areas. And as I say, people have looked at that and you don't find any evidence for that.
Sure, we're gonna turn to our audience in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, what would you advise parents who are just starting on this journey? You know, they have a child who's been diagnosed with autism. How do we help them? And how should government and communities help them? And not only the child with autism, but the adult, right? So the child grows up, and now how do we help that adult with autism? What would be your advice to those families?
Okay. So, I mean, those are two very different questions. I think we've done an enormous amount, and there are so many resources that I can point families to, you know, in terms of support services, in terms of, you know, communities that they can join and participate in, you know, the Moms of Autism Facebook groups are among the most active Facebook groups that are out there. And so I think we've got a lot of resource. That wouldn't be the only thing I would point to. But there's lots of areas that I would point parents to, that we do point parents to, where they can get some support acquire some tools for how to navigate the system, because it is a system they're going to navigate for years, how to support their own child, what are the best ways of communicating with your child who's autistic and may not use spoken language, lots of things like that. So I think we do have those systems in place. Of course, they're far more available in some areas compared to others. And in rural areas, that's difficult. But you can connect them. I think social media today and the availability of resources, reputable resources on the internet, are very, very helpful for families. Adults is a different story. We have neglected the adult population. And of course, all these children are growing up, and we need a whole different set of resources. I mean, as children, they enter into the educational system, they go to schools, and they're supported in schools, depending on which state, until they're, you know, late teens or early 20s. And then life is very different, and many families talk about that transition to adulthood as if they're falling off a cliff, because the resources are far less available. The needs are in some ways far greater. What about housing? What about programming? What about job opportunities and job training? What about continued school? If my child is eligible and capable of going to college, what kind of supports can I expect for my child going to college? Some schools are doing a great deal in that area, other schools a little bit less so. So, you know, those are different questions. And I think that's an area where we're seeing a lot of movement today, because we are recognizing not only that the children who we diagnosed early on are growing up and moving into adulthood, but we're also have a whole other population of people who they weren't diagnosed as children. But now, as they're growing older, they're beginning to recognize, because information about autism is so much more available, and everyone knows about autism now in a way they just didn't decades ago. And they're now recognizing that perhaps some of the challenges that they experience through their lives, maybe because they themselves have autism. I mean, over the years we've had in our studies, I would say more than two dozen parents who, after their child was diagnosed, then said, okay, this is me. And they went and themselves were able to receive a diagnosis of autism themselves. They, of course, have managed to make it through life in a way without the, you know, needing the diagnosis. Although they all say it's so much more helpful to understand that the social problems they had, the difficulty in relationships, the difficulties at work, understanding that the roots of that are in fact lie in their autism diagnosis, which they only recently got.
That goes back to the genetics issue. And with regards to helping the community when they get older, goes back to one of our former first ladies who said it takes a village, right? So it really does. I want to go to our subscribers, but as we're getting that ready, I wondered if you had three takeaways maybe you could share for all of us regarding the issues of diagnosis, of autism or possible causes that we could just make sure we share with those who are listening.
Okay. Well, I think my first and last takeaway, but I'll put others in between, that autism is a very complex disorder. And in fact, today, many researchers talk about the autisms in the plural, that we're not talking about a single construct here. We're talking about a variety of different, there's some shared core features, but in so many ways, every other way, these individuals are, it's a very complex disorder with more than one, more than many causes, and more than many different ways that we should approach in terms of intervention, treatment, supports, and needs of the individual. So the complexity of autism cannot be, we just can't emphasize that enough. I'd also want to say that we have learned a huge amount of autism over the last 30, 40 years. Doing the science is hard, okay? And it takes time, and it takes a lot of people. So in all the work I do, I collaborate with people who come from many different fields now. And I think that's what's allowed us to advance. So, you know, I work with people who study the genetics, who study the brain, who study animal models, who study interventions, who study infants. So, you know, it takes everybody that kind of contribution. But the progress is clear. I can trace where we were 50 years ago to where we are today. And in my mind, a huge amount of progress has been made. And I would also say there's so much more available now in terms of interventions compared to where we were. But it's a foundation. We still have so many more questions. The more we learn, the more questions get opened up. So there's a huge amount that we still need to be doing. And What I'm looking forward to is seeing people, the next generations, building on the foundation of the last several decades of research and taking us far further along to the point where we're really able to meet the needs of every individual who is somewhere on that autism spectrum.
Well, you've been, I'm sure, an incredible mentor to many, many of the students and graduate students and young faculty of the next generation. So we all thank you for what you've done. We've had a chance to speak about so many issues. I mean, we could talk for another year on this, and obviously you've spent more than 1 year working on this. So there's a lot of information out there. But we want to turn to our most important guests, which are our subscribers out there. So we're going to tee that up now. And I do want to mention, as I always do, that the podcast is for informational purposes. And we have been talking about a lot of medical issues today. So, but if you do have medical questions, you really should talk to your doctor, because they know your medical history, which is the best way to get the answers for your own particular care. But Kat, can we go to the first question? Although I know you usually have the first question, so
I usually do. But I want to give the audience some time to ask their questions
okay.
and drop them in there.
Okay.
But I am going to bring up Joe first, so that he can ask you guys a question.
Joe, how are you?
Hi there. Hey, funny enough, I live in Houston, Texas, and very fortunate that, especially in my neighborhood, we have an ABA therapy center down here. So there's lots of resources. I know there's lots of folks in my neighborhood who have children with autism. So very thankful to have that support and those resources. I also feel, especially in the last, maybe it's even 20 years, that the definition itself of autism has grown dramatically. And it almost seems like these days, if someone may have a small personality quirk or something like that, it is now part of the autism spectrum. But I also grew up going to school with children that were severely autistic, and I would volunteer in the classroom when I was in school growing up, and you know, helping some of these kids before and after school. And so, do you feel like this broader identification of autism, really, does it overshadow the experiences of those who have severe needs and more profound support requirements related to their autism? Or is it ultimately better for the awareness of the autism spectrum as it is?
I mean, those are really important observations that you make. Certainly, we are able now to detect subtler differences in social communication that are part of the defining symptoms. And we are more willing to provide a diagnosis when those are presented in a very mild way, okay? Than we used to. And that's changing over time. And it's like the more expertise you have in identifying social communication problems, the more you see these subtle differences. Maybe we've gone too far. I don't know. I'm not personally a clinician. All the work I currently do is, in fact, with the more profoundly autistic end of the spectrum. I think in terms of research, we could do far more research on the profoundly autistic end of the spectrum. It's very challenging, but the needs are far greater in lots of ways. But I want to go back to the milder individuals that you mentioned. These are people, and I know a lot of adults who fall into that category. And of course, compared to the profoundly autistic people I know, I think, well, you know, they're semi-independent. They can, you know, they're very articulate. They're super smart. They have so many gifts and abilities. But at the same time, they do have significant challenges. It's very hard for them to be in, for example, a workplace where the demands on you and the needs to be very communicative and very attentive to all the subtle nonverbal cues going on around you. It's very challenging for them. So it's not that they don't have needs and for which supports would be enormously helpful. And so I don't think we should stop diagnosing across that full spectrum. Okay? The needs are very different. And as I was saying a little bit before, this is part of the reason why we talk about the autisms as opposed to the singular, and we can think of it in, you know, this is one of the many dimensions on which we can think of the multiple ways in which autism is now recognized in our society.
Joe, what do you hear from the community, the parents that you speak with? Do they feel they have the resources they need? You mentioned there was facility there. Are there things they feel that government should be doing? Are they concerned about some of the things they're hearing about? Everyone pushing always the issue of vaccines. I mean, what have you heard from them?
Living in Texas, I have a lot of friends that are on both sides of the political spectrum. Friends who have not diagnosed their children or who have not, sorry, vaccinated their children at all. Some who are great proponents of it, and so you really hear the full gamut of opinions. But I can tell you, especially. Having an ABA therapy center that is so close to where we live has been really attractive, and it's been great for even things like home value. You know, more people want to move to places like this because they have those resources available. And so I can tell you, it's really nice to be able to have that support nearby. And I know if I have friends who or if I know of children who may have autism that at least nearby, we can direct them to a place that's really going to be helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. Great question, and great, as Helen mentioned, observations. Thank you. Kat, who do we have next?
Yep, I'm going to bring up Miss Ronnie. She has a question, I think a question or two for you guys.
Great.
Ronnie. I tend to freeze. I'm sorry. My bandwidth is not great today. It's so nice to see you, Dr. Zucker and Dr. Traeger Flesberg. Thank you so much for your work and all you're doing. I also want to thank you for bringing up the idea of adults with autism. I have a friend who's very worried about her son. He's in his 30s, but when she eventually passes on, she's just so concerned what is going to happen to him. So, a whole other topic for another time. But my question for today is related to the brain development and neurology. And it really is, there's two parts to it. You know, what is the difference in brain structure or brain function that's associated with autism? And are these differences present from birth or do they develop after birth?
Okay, that's really a very good question. Although I will say, as an aside, your friend who has a son with profound autism, I'm going to push for your friend to look up the Profound Autism Alliance, which is a new organization that was started 2 years ago and provides incredible community resources advocacy for that part of the population.
Thank
Okay.
you.
And people have been searching for what are the differences in the brain. I think when I started, I honestly thought we would sort of find that little hole in the head. And it wasn't just me, I think we all sort of, almost metaphorically, but almost not metaphorically. Because, of course, back then we couldn't even investigate what was going on inside the head. I think the differences in the brain are subtle. And, of course, in our research, what do? We compare a group of people who are diagnosed with autism to a group of people who are not who are diagnosed not to have autism. But they're really over, it turns out, when we look at their brain structure and we look at their brain function, they are very overlapping, especially if we rely on studies using magnetic resonance imaging. Which, if you know anything about it, to get a lovely, those beautiful pictures of the brain that we get from MRIs, you have to lie down in a very constricted environment as this gigantic, rather scary-looking machine takes pictures of your brain. And all the while it is doing so, you have to remain completely still. So who do you think we study when we study brain development in that way? We study people who do overlap enormously with the non-autistic population. And it is much harder to study the brain in profoundly autistic people. We do know that there are significant differences if we use other brain technologies, like such as electrophysiology. In the more profoundly autistic people, we see different patterns of electrical activity that seem to reflect a sort of a noisy brain. There's much more noise in the system. So if you think about it, it's sort of like having very poor, much poorer wiring. We know that the areas of the brain, so if you look at what's involved at the level of brain activity to process language, okay, there are several critical regions of the brain that are all involved while I'm sitting here producing speech. So that in fact, if you were to look at my brain activity, it's like almost the whole brain, but there are certain critical regions that are involved. And those are highly connected. And that connectivity between the different areas involved in processing language is pretty important for how well I process the language. And there's different lower levels of connectivity in autism. But again, there's a lot of overlap. So we thought we would find those clear brain differences. It's not as clear as we thought originally. It comes back to the point I've been making about how complex the disorder is.
That's a very, that's a very clear explanation. I just wanted to, before I sign off, Joe reminded me of a story I once did about Mesa, Arizona. They're a very friendly autism city. And they're trying to, I guess the first labeled friendly autism city, and their model is available for other cities around the country to develop so that people are welcome there. And they've created a great deal of tourism for families with autism. And I thought that was just like a really interesting approach. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that program there, but it's quite interesting.
I don't, but I would love to go and visit it and to tell people I know. But that raises a couple of interesting points. When you have an area that sort of advertises itself as a friendly place where there are resources and activities and support systems, people who have the ability to do so will move there, okay? Mm-hmm. And for years, I live in Massachusetts, and people would come to Massachusetts. I can remember several families who were in my studies. They moved to Massachusetts when they were given an option to do so because they knew that their child would have far better educational opportunities here than they were at that point getting wherever it was that they were coming from. And then that feeds back into these huge disparities in the rates that we see between different cities, the difference between Houston and Laredo, Texas, that I talked about at the beginning. And just to get back to the brain, to your question about the brain, that's actually a topic that's very close to my heart about when they begin. And we study babies, and we see that these differences in the brain, which are not clearly interpretable, but we use electrophysiology, and we see that their brains are functioning differently soon after birth. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that, in fact, over time, their brains look more similar to the non-autistic babies, but they're not autistic at birth, okay, because we can't diagnose it until they're 2 or 3 years old. But we follow babies to the point where we can do a diagnosis. And what we see is that when we look back at the brain activity that we collected when they were not newborns, but 3, 4 months old, we can pick out which are the babies now who ended up with an autism diagnosis. So the answer is those differences in the brain some of them, and there's other work in this area by other groups showing that differences are there in young infants.
Well, that would go back to in utero, right? That goes back to some of the issues on the 9 months of development.
Yes.
Sorry, Ronnie, go ahead.
It's very compelling. I hope that the administration gets lucky and can find out what causes autism in the next 6 months. That would be amazing.
And I would add that the wraparound services, these social support services, money should be going to that. We should be doing the research and everything else, but we need to also invest in those social services that are needed so that the communities that have them could be a model for the communities that don't in many ways. Kat, I know we're at an hour. Kat, do we have other questions or should we wrap up?
We have a shy group today, so that is all the questions we have for today.
Great, great. Well, thank you, Dr. Tager Flusberg. This has been a pleasure. Your knowledge of this is just unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. And I believe what you shared is what our viewers need to hear. The facts, and not fiction, not narratives, but really what the facts are that we know today, and hopefully we'll have more and more facts as time goes on. And at that point, hopefully we'll have more answers and we'll help more people who have autism, as well as those who are going to diagnose people with autism. But I wanted to thank you very much for coming on.
I want to thank you for focusing on this topic and for asking very good questions and having subscribers with very good questions too.
Well, hopefully we'll have an opportunity to speak more about this as you know, the year goes on in a future podcast, and I will follow up on some of the suggestions you made as other things to look into as well for podcasts. So that's our show for today. Next time on Docology, we're going to speak with the president of the American Dental Association to talk about fluoride in the water, another issue that has been in the news lately. But do remember that if you are a Docology subscriber, you can join the show. All you have to do is click on the link in the bio. So tune in next time because the topic we cover may just save your life. Docology is a production of Hang Media. Our producer is Catherine Warren. Ronnie Selig is editorial advisor. Our creative director is Anna Richard. Janine Wilson of Wilson Media Group handles paid marketing. Our publicists are Leslie Ann Wade and Jerry Caracoli. Theme music was composed by Nick Kitts. Subscribe and join our community at docology.life. Until next time, move, wash your hands, and stay healthy.